The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.
This is the Retirement and IRA Show coming to you from beautiful Northern Colorado. Join us as certified financial planner Jim Salnier, as well as Colorado State University finance instructor and certified financial planner Chris Stein, teach you about IRAs, 401ks, annuities, Social Security, pension plans, and estate planning in a fun and enjoyable show. Whether you are listening live in Colorado or streaming from their website or iTunes podcast, Jim and Chris want you to know that they're available to help you plan for your retirement. Just visit their website at jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And click the Meet the Team button on the homepage. Now, here's Jim and Chris with today's show.
Well, hello and welcome to the Retirement and IRA Show EDU edition for this week. On this week's show, it's going to be the third in a series where we've been discussing our concept of asset positioning, which is our way of, we'll call it allocating assets in order to assign jobs to those assets or resources. And that job usually entails two variables. When are the dollars needed and for what purpose? And that helps inform us as to where we feel that you should place those assets or position those assets. So if you're not sure what we mean by the word positioning, that's kind of my quickie definition. And today we're going to have Jim and Jacob back on, and we're going to continue on with a prompt from a listener where they were particularly concerned or interested in positioning assets, not once they are in retirement, but rather as they're approaching retirement. And this listener, I believe, is about 5 years out from retirement. And recently, in the past 6 months or so, we've talked about positioning quite a lot, but hadn't talked directly very much about positioning in that kind of those pre-retirement years as you're close in what we call the transition period between accumulation and decumulation, or the spending years of retirement. So I'll bring in Jacob and Jim now, and they can fill in any gaps they feel that I left for the description of what we're going to talk about today, and then we'll continue on with our little series here on this topic. So, Jacob, thanks for joining us again.
Yeah, happy to be here. Happy to be here.
Yeah, and Jim's here as well, although he's being unexpectedly quiet.
Well, I am here. I was letting Jacob say his hellos.
Oh, nice.
But we have a little PSA from a listener on the Venn diagram, because that essentially is the main topic, if you will, folks, of this listener question. And it was somebody who was in the transition phase of retirement. They were no longer purely accumulating, and they were no longer decumulating. And in the office, we call this the Venn diagram, where the accumulation and the decumulation are overlapping, little circles are overlapping. And I asked what that overlap part was called.
Oh, yeah.
And we received an email, said, Jim, on a recent show, you were asking what the overlapping area of a Venn diagram is called. As an academic librarian, we often use Venn diagrams when teaching students information searching skills. The overlap is called the intersection.
Oh, good to know.
Good to know.
It's a fun fact of the day.
And she goes on to throw you a carrot. She says, and Chris is right. The diagram is named for John Venn, 1834 to 1923. The English mathematician, philosopher, and Anglican priest who developed the diagram that carries his name. And she said, and here is an interesting piece of Venn diagram trivia. Gee, I wonder if we should play this against ChatGPT. I don't have my iPad, so I can't. Because I'm wondering if chat would know this. There is a stained glass window at Gonville and, oh God, she put this in here on purpose. How would you pronounce C-A-I-U-S?
Caius, maybe?
Yeah. All right, Gonville and Caius College in Cambridge. I don't know if that's Cambridge, England, or yeah. Cambridge, Mass, or any other Cambridge, honoring Venn. There is a Venn diagram depicted in the window, which I personally think is extremely cool. So at some stained glass window at Gonville and Caius College in Cambridge.
And I think it's in his little bio, it's not an angelic priest, it's Anglican. Just to be clear. So everybody knows what we're talking about.
It's not angelic?
No. No, Anglican.
I was testing you. You did very good. You picked up on that. I like, see how he picked up on that, Jacob? Where were you?
I don't know. I need a couple more episodes of me before I can start
picking
up.
And I only felt I needed
that.
To say that so that people wouldn't write in and say I didn't pick up on it. So just, I wasn't really trying to pick on Jim. It was.
Well, longtime listeners will be, oh, that's just Jim. It's not what he says. It's what he means. But thank you for clarifying that and picking up on my test. Jacob, you failed miserably. All righty. So anyways, there is a little bit of history there on the Venn diagram. I thank that listener. Today's segment or topic, if you will, folks, is a continuation of that gentleman's question. And he, again, was 5 years from retirement and worried because of the way the equity markets were performing. Now, this has been several weeks, actually probably more than a month since he sent that email. I just looked literally today as I was getting on the show, and year to date, the S&P is down only 5.2 now. So hopefully this tariff tantrum is working its way out. And I'm hoping people, listeners, learned from this, not to let their emotions rule the day. And I know it's hard. You get emotionally invested in your retirement and in your portfolio. And it's very easy. It's called recency bias. It's probably one of the worst behavioral finance biases that humans have, where they convince themselves, some quite quickly, others it takes a long time, that whatever is happening now is going to continue happening. This time is different. It's never coming back. Things are going to stay crappy, and it's going to last forever. It's kind of recency bias, they call it. Now, recency bias isn't all negative. During good times, you tend to think, this is great. Equities never go down. Things are going to keep going up forever. This is beautiful. So recency bias is very real, and it's not just in finance. It's anywhere in our lives. We tend to think when things are going really good, just this is great. But especially when things are going bad, we being humans, we're very prone to convincing ourselves it's never going to change. Part of the reason I came up with the Secure Retirement Income process, the entire approach, this fund number way of planning your retirement, we've shared this many times over, go look at the old shows. But one of the issues I always had is I truly felt, and Chris from day one when I hired him shared in maybe not in the same verbiage that I use, but shared that to him that also is a risk with retirement. And it's not overspending and running out of money, which gets all the attention. It's underspending and dying with too much money. Now, you should die with something. We concede that. but we don't want you dying with fun. Money left over is life unlived. I've said that many times over, but I'm specifically talking fun money left over is life unlived. Aging reserves left over, guaranteed inheritances left over, buffers left over. Those are designed to be left over. But fun, that's designed to be consumed. And part of the reason I came up with concepts of the fun number, what I call the toys in a toy box, the see-through portfolio, all of these concepts, and if they're alien to you, if you don't know what I'm talking about, listen to earlier shows, please. But these whole concepts were designed for one thing, to hopefully help people overcome the emotions of retiring, which is going to freak you out, and then down markets and the emotions you feel on losses. And Chris, you mentioned last week, and I'm not familiar with that part of behavioral finance, and I forgot what you called it, but you said humans react worse to losses than positives, correct?
Correct. That's called prospect theory, and it's been well documented, not just with financial losses, but they did a lot of studies with sports competitors as well, that humans don't value equally, at least on an emotional basis, wins and losses. And with financial situations, wins and losses, we're talking about gains and losses financially, that you feel emotionally a magnitude of 2 or 3 times the negative as you do the positive of a win financially. So that tends to affect people and their decision making. So, and that's why it's included as one of the key biases.
So the whole idea of positioning, which is nothing more than a form of, the industry, the academics call it time segmented investing. I call it spending segmented investing. But the concept remains the same. Money that you're going to need sooner rather than later should be invested far more conservatively than money that isn't going to be needed for a very long time. The theory being, money that you might spend this year, next year, the year after, because you need it in such a short time frame, significant losses or even minor losses may not be recouped in time. So when you have to spend it, the money's not there. Conversely, if you can do some calculations and show more likely than not, these dollars won't be spent for 20 years. Theoretically, if they're dropping in 2025, but they're not needed to maybe 2045, what's it matter? And I've said before, the adage, if a tree falls in the forest and nobody is there, did it make a noise? I like to say, if your portfolio dropped in value, but you don't need the money, does it really matter? And if you don't need the money for 20 years, hopefully this tariff tantrum wasn't panicking the heck out of you on those dollars. And if you were already retired and the tariff tantrum was going on, hopefully you weren't panicking on dollars that had a degree of principal protection or dollars that were fully principal protected because you're going to be spending them over the next 1 or 2 or 3 years. Who cares if other parts of your portfolio are dropping? The money that you need over the next 1, 2, 3 years has that principal protection. So with all of that, this gentleman was still saying, though, but Jim, I get that, but I'm 5 years from retirement. How do I start moving my dollars into a positioned portfolio? So we tried to explain last week that the first thing he needs to do, if he likes our approach to retirement planning, he needs to determine his delay period minimum dignity floor and his fund vision. Chris explained last week how that's done. Listen to last week's show. Because those are the two positions, if you will, that need the most principal protection. The remaining positions, which is the remaining spending, because I do spending segmented investing, each position is different spending, if you will, at various times of your retirement. Except for those two positions, delayed period minimum dignity floor needs, and that's pretty much the money that he's going to need in 5 years when he retires, up until his Social Security is turned on. I don't know what this gentleman's age was, but that's the delay period. And last week, we pretended, because we don't know his exact delay period, we said, Chris, let's just pretend it's 12 years. So you've been doing this long enough, Chris, and I did speak to Jacob before the show, and he knows that the number is 12 years, because he's going to talk how this gentleman can start approaching this. But can you provide Jacob a reasonable dollar amount for what you would see a 12-year delay period MDF might be? For the average person that we might be working with, or the average listener, or whatever. Just come up with something that you
think is reasonable. If it's that long of a delay period, it can certainly, if they have no other income coming in during that point in time, you know, during that time period, that 12 years, it could easily be $1 million. Because, you know, typical minimum dignity floor that we see in 2025 dollars is somewhere around $75,000, $80,000, but that's going to go up over that 12-year period with inflation. So I'd put that estimate right about $1 million.
Perfect. And let's just assume that there is some income coming in. Maybe they're a married couple or they got a small pension. So netting out the assumed income they're going to get for the next 12 years, $700,000 is remaining, Jacob. Okay?
Got it.
Okay.
Perfect. Now, Chris also shared that this gentleman would need to determine his fund vision. Let's just assume he did that, Chris. Jacob needs a number. Can you just come up with a reasonable fund vision for Jacob?
I mean, that could be all over the board, but have we talked about how much total assets these people have?
He didn't provide any of that, Chris. So I was just hoping you could kind of base it off of
your typical client case. Yeah, I'd say $1.5 million.
Okay.
Maybe $1.5 million, so, something like that.
A $1.5 million fund vision, not fund number, fund vision. He's not going to get, or any of you won't get your actual fund number until you do the full plan. And that was his point. He hadn't done a plan yet. He's thinking, I'm 5 years from retirement. Now's around the time that I have to. I'm assuming he's going to do a plan similar to our approach, whether he's doing it himself or he has an advisor. If you are doing it a Monte Carlo-based plan with a safe withdrawal rate, or if you're doing guardrails or ceiling and floor, whatever your approach is, you'll have to come up with your own number. We're talking in the realm of how we do retirement planning. So the fund vision is a little different, but remember, he's in the Venn diagram, folks. And Jacob is perfectly fine with a fund vision number, and he's going to explain to you what he's doing. So, Jacob, just assume the fund vision is $1.5 million now.
Yeah.
The listeners, you don't need all $1.5 million on day one of retirement. You don't need all $700,000 on day one of retirement on the delay period MDF. The delay period MDF is going to be comprised of 12 different rungs of a ladder, if you will, because it's fairly linear in how we calculate it. Here's what we project the minimum dignity floor to be, minus the, I said, $300,000 of total income, but it'll come at various times over that 12-year period. So in each year, we're going to be able to estimate about how much they're going to need. Chris, the fund vision number is really broken to go-go as well as slow-go and no-go. Go-go, folks, is the dollars that you're going to spend when you have the health, inclination, desire, and ability to spend on fun. Slow-go and no-go, we hope they're brought about because you're just aging into them, which usually begins around your mid-70s. Unfortunately, things can happen. We call it the other guy. Something can happen when all of a sudden your go-go years are over. But I do know, and I'm going to involve Chris in this, because he got me to really rethink my beliefs. And at first, I used to encourage people. This is when they had their actual fun number. But for a Venn diagram, I'm happy with the fun vision. I would say, hey, you should try to spend about half during your go-go years. I don't say that anymore, and I haven't said it for a long time. But Chris, you're the one who changed my mind on that. Jacob needs a dollar amount for go-go. Why don't you explain to people, if you were working with someone, how would you encourage them to look at their go-go during this beginning phase of retirement? And Jacob and I did agree the go-go is going to be projected. I came up with 15 years, folks, because if they have a 12-year, and I don't know how we came up last week with 12 years, if they have a 12-year delay MDF, that means they're hitting 70 in our hypothetical example about 12 years from now. Mm-hmm. Most people start slowing down when they get into their mid-70s. So that's why I came up with 15 years, Chris. Mm-hmm. But help Jacob come with a dollar amount and get people to look at go-go the way you got me to look at it.
Well, I think because of the importance of it and the fact that it's the younger retirees that are typically doing things that cost more money. And when I say cost more money, what I see in retirement, having done, not being retired myself, but having done hundreds and hundreds of retirement plans at this point, that travel or expensive hobbies are usually where the big dollars flow, or maybe a large purchase, a second home, a vacation home, a expensive RV, something like that. But all of those are happening during what we call the go-go period. Once you're not doing those things, either because you've done them for so long, you're tired of doing them now, you know, you've checked off all the places you wanted to see, and you're just getting tired of dealing with airports and that sort of thing, that your travel trails off and your expensive hobbies. Not too many people have what I would call expensive hobbies, but I've seen a few. And when I saw them, I thought, oh, that's just as impactful or just as expensive as international travel. So not as many of you will do that. I will say travel is the number one expense, for heavy go-go spenders. That the only time you're really going to be able to do that is during this so-called go-go period. You're not going to be doing much of that. There's the lucky few that are healthy enough and aren't burned out that are continuing to do significant expensive travel, not basic travel. We're not saying you're just, you know, going to stop traveling completely in your mid-70s, but we really, with a few exceptions, see it trail off tremendously. And for that reason, I became, you know, convinced in my own mind, and I think I convinced Jim talking to him that, you know, the go-go period shouldn't be half. It should be 70, maybe plus percent of your overall fund spending should really be thought of in the go-go period. And there's two reasons. A, I've already explained one. That's when a lot of the expensive fun is happening. And secondly, because it happens soon, you have to devote more money to it because there's not much time for it to grow. Those two factors mean that later on in your slow go and no go periods, not only is your consumption lower, you're likely to do less things that are expensive in the fun category, you also have the benefit of time on your side. So the dollars to be dedicated today to that purpose have time to, grow, in the assumptions of most people. So, for that reason, I feel a lot more comfortable with people dedicating 70 plus percent of their fun overall allocation, if you will, to that go-go period.
Perfect. So what we have here, folks, is again, a gentleman retiring in 5 years, estimated he will need about $700,000. And again, this is all being made up. We got the idea from the listener who sent the email, but there was no specifics to his situation, so we created a hypothetical example. So we have someone retiring in 5 years. They have done no positioning yet. They did crunch some numbers. when they feel they're going to need $700,000 total for the delay period minimum dignity floor expense. That's from retirement to about age 70. How much money they're going to need after accounting for any income that they will be receiving. How much will they need to cover their food, utilities, transportation, housing, and health care? They also crunched some numbers and came up with a fund vision of about $1.5 million. That's not their fund number, but it's very close. It's on the target, may not quite be the bullseye, but it's definitely on the target. And let's just say, Jacob, they're going to, and Chris, they're going to spend out of that $1.5 million, they're willing to allocate about 3/4 of it to their go-go period, which is 15 years long. It does not mean they're going to spend 3/4 of it. They might spend 80% of it. They might spend 50% of it. When we, as our firm, say they're going to allocate these dollars to go-go, we believe that nearly all go-go should have a degree of principal protection to it. And the reason we believe that, and passionately, is one of the worst things, and this tariff tantrum is a good example of it, is somebody not spending on fun, someone convincing themselves, this time is different. It's just going to keep going down forever. This is crazy. I'm fearful. I'm this, I'm that. And they put off doing something fun. And maybe they take a year or two to decide, okay, things are better. I'm going to do it. But maybe something happens to them and they become the other guy. And their ability to ever do what they put off doing out of some fear that was beyond their control, to us, is a risk not worth taking. So if your go-go money can have a degree of principal protection, doesn't mean cash, and Jacob's going to explain that, but just enough of a principal protection where hopefully you won't panic at the wrong time and delay spending on fun. That's why we say go-go has a degree of principal protection, slow-go and no-go doesn't. Like Chris just said, those dollars have time to grow. You don't need to put the degree of principal protection, because any principal protection holds back potential growth. That's the trade-off. And when I say a degree of protection, it's everywhere from 100% guaranteed, you're never going to lose in it, all the way up to maybe just a 10% downside buffer. But that's a degree of principal protection, which Jacob will get into. So we have, according to my math, Chris, and you can proof it, a go-go reserve of about $1,125,000. Is my math right if they were going to spend 75% of $1.5 million, Chris?
Yes, that's what I got as well.
Excellent. So, Jacob, if you now were handling an initial call, because most of the people we work with or you work with are you're on Zoom, and you just knew these situations, that someone is getting a hold of you, they're 5 years from retirement, they might be going through a retirement plan and getting their numbers together, and they want to talk to you about how to start looking at this Venn diagram period, and they're a little bit nervous because of the tariff tantrum or the COVID or the housing market or whatever is causing the latest market turmoil. Walk our listeners through the conversation you're going to be having with them, and how will that run, and what will you be saying to them?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. So, I mean, the first thing, and I know we talked about this in the last show, but the first thing you just want to kind of reiterate here, right, is in the case of this listener with being 5 years away from retirement, I know, Jim, you've mentioned a handful of times, but even on these laddered kind of positions, right? The delay period MDF, the fund, the go-go fund spending, right? The dollars that this listener is going to start spending as they enter retirement. with them being, 5 years away from retirement, it's not as though they need to sit there and panic and say, "Hey, well, okay, I haven't made any changes. I haven't started positioning anything. I need to start getting these yearly kind of liquid amounts set aside, right now for my entire 12-year delay period, time period, in my entire, 15-year or go-go period," let's just say in this specific example. With this person kind of falling into the transitionary phase, I would first kind of mention that, hey, you've got 5 years until retirement. Yes, I would think in our eyes, we would encourage this listener to kind of try and prioritize and focus on getting at least the first year or two into retirement, in kind of that liquidity account that we've talked about, or getting those dollars at least allocated in principal protection. But I don't think they necessarily need to sit back right now in this transition phase and worry so much about getting the entire kind of delay period MDF or the entire go-go ladder, all allocated at once. If we're looking at, guys, numbers that let's say, we're looking at years kind of three, four, five, six of this listener's retirement, and they're still 5 years out from even retiring themselves, right? That gives this person, whether it's a five, six, seven, eight, nine, 10-year kind of time horizon before even some of those middle portions of these positions that we're talking about need to start being kind of allocated into investments with at least a degree of principal protection. So that's kind of the first thing I would definitely mention. And I know we've spoken about that a little bit, but I would definitely kind of focus on saying, hey, we're 5 years out from retirement. Let's look at, the assumptions of what this listener feels they're going to need for both the delay period minimum dignity floor, right? The kind of food, utilities, transportation, housing, and healthcare expenses, and at least maybe the first year or two of what their anticipated fund spending is going to be, right? The full discretionary fund spending amounts. And those are the two kind of pools I would focus on getting this listener to acknowledge, hey, those are the dollar amounts we're going to want to start to kind of, build a little bit of principal protection into, whether it is a liquidity account, whether it is some existing holdings that maybe this listener has that would actually fall into that pool of principal protection. And that's kind of the first thing I would say for this listener, and then I would kind of recommend, right, is go ahead, take a look at, your statements in this example, all the accounts you might have, whether it's, all your bank accounts, all your retirement style of accounts, your maybe taxable brokerage style of accounts, right? And kind of start to take an inventory of which holdings you have across those different style of accounts. And I know I acknowledge, right, everybody probably listening to this podcast, I'm sure you guys have done this, right? And you have a good feel for all the holdings that exist in your overall accounts. But in this example, I'm maybe more so picking on, the neighbor, right, who's not listening to a retirement kind of podcast, and maybe they don't have quite as good of an understanding of where everything kind of currently sits. But even still, even if you feel you have a good understanding of which holdings you have, all across your variety of accounts, I would still encourage you to go back, look at the existing holdings, and kind of see is there any holdings that I have right now already that would actually kind of match, that kind of principal protection for at least the first year or two of the anticipated need for delay period minimum dignity floor and fund spending, right? Some easy examples of kind of holdings that I'm talking about, right? In, 401k accounts or maybe some employer style accounts like that, right? Maybe this listener has some dollars allocated in something like a stable value fund, right? That's a pretty common, holding offered across, 401k specifically, but maybe even other employer style of accounts. Those are dollars, right? If this listener had money in the stable value holding, that's a typical holding that, Jim, Chris, and I would all kind of consider to be a principally protected style of investment. And that could be earmarked towards these first kind of year or two of retirement here, as this listener, gets to that point in time, 5 years from now, right? Other example, maybe a more common example across the accounts cut could be something like short-term bonds, right? Maybe there's existing short-term bond holdings that could actually be fitting the bill and earmarked for these first year or two of kind of the anticipated MDF and fund spending need as well. Bond funds and short-term bond funds in general, a couple of little, caveats or things just to keep in mind there, right? We wouldn't consider a bond fund to, by the standard definition, be a principally protected holding, as, 2022 showed kind of everybody, right? Bonds can lose principal and they can be down like they were in 2022. Open-ended kind of bond funds, right? Like your typical short-term bond index fund, right? That fund doesn't have a defined maturity date, folks. So unlike an individual bond or, you know, a CD or even an ETF that has a defined maturity date where they're saying, hey, if I hold this print, you know, if I hold this bond for, you know, the another year through the end of April of 2026, right, I know I'm going to get my principal back and I've been paid the interest for essentially loaning that money for the last kind of year. In bond funds where there's no defined maturity date like that, right? The fund itself is having to go out and constantly buy new short-term bond funds. So there, that does expose you to a little bit of, you know, principal risk, like we were saying in 2022, and interest rate risk, right? If rates are going up, existing bonds go down. Rates are going down, existing bond values kind of go up. So just kind of keep that in mind, right? I'm not saying short-term bond holdings are a perfect, you know, one-for-one kind of allocation for the first year or two of these kind of spending needs that we're talking about. But it's at least a starting place where you can kind of say, hey, I've already got some money earmarked in kind of these less, you know, theoretically less kind of volatile, maybe closer to principally protected kind of allocations. And maybe they can just start to kind of pencil some of those existing assets towards some of these early needs, right? Without freaking out, without making any, you know, changes in a market where there is, you know, short-term volatility going on. Granted, you know, a lot of it has kind of bounced back, like Jim mentioned, but, you know, maybe this listener has some existing holdings that they can kind of slot into those places without kind of making any changes. So that's really the first thing that I would kind of encourage this person to do. And granted, maybe that is wishful thinking, right? Let's say this person doesn't have any of those kind of you know, closer to principal protection or stable value funds that they could kind of earmark towards these reserves. You know, maybe they're more allocated in equities, right? And things are kind of volatile with the existing kind of markets there. Again, the concept kind of stays the same. I would encourage this person to kind of remember, you know, even if you do hold, you know, equities, even if the markets are kind of temporarily down, right? Assuming that they've held these funds for a long time, right? They might be down from the previous high if we're picking on the S&P in this example, but hopefully if they've been invested, you know, for the last, gosh, whether it's, you know, 5, 10, 15, 25 years, right? I'm assuming this listener has seen some longer term growth on some of those equity holdings that they have. And granted, yes, emotionally, I understand, right? Sitting there in their shoes and thinking, hey, gosh, well, you know, it sucks to sell and move some of my equity holdings to principal protection now because the market's down, you know, what, 5.2% or 8% or 10% from its previous high. But when you take a step back and you look at the broader overall picture, and I don't want to make any assumptions, but I would think in general, right, if these are longer term holds, you know, this listener is probably still up over the long term as they've kind of been invested. And so although they're going to, you know, not maybe time it perfect as nobody would be able to do, right, and make these changes at the market highs, they're still going to be able to make some of these changes without having a drastic, you know, effect, right? If they have to make changes and they're down 5.2%, so what? I mean, you have to, at some point, you have to kind of start making these allocation changes, and you have to start to allocate the first year or two of anticipated MDF and fund spending into instruments with a degree of principal protection. And again, hopefully the concept of sitting back and saying, hey, okay, my delay period's 12 years long, my go-go period, or my fund spending, my go-go period is 15 years long. Hopefully this listener can sit back and say, okay, I'm 5 years from retirement. I don't need to ladder out the full 12 years or the full 15 years. I can really focus on getting good estimates for the first year or two and kind of using that as a starting point for starting to kind of position some of these spending dollars in principal protection.
I think you did excellent, Jacob. That's exactly what I wanted you to explain, and this is exactly what you do. And what I want our listeners to take away from what Jacob was saying, it's the first thing you need to do is take a survey, take a inventory of what you own. And for many people listening, if not nearly all, you do that all the time. However, I've often said you guys are the vanguard, not just because most of you invest your money at Vanguard, but because you're probably the go-to person that your family, your friends, your colleagues, your neighbors are going to be going to because they know you geek out on this. And just try to calm the people down and get them to start taking an inventory of their holdings. Because one of the things that we have seen doesn't happen all the time, but that's why we start as the first step If we're working with someone in the Venn diagram phase, totally different if they're already retired or something like that, or if they're still 15 years from retirement. But if in that Venn diagram phase, first step, let's see what you got. Because some of them may not be perfect, but they'll adequately fit for one of these two pools of money. The minimum dignity floor delay period or the go-go fund spending. And these are big numbers, 700,000 in the delay period, 1.1 or so million in the go-go. Does that mean we want $1.8 million of liquidity in 5 more years? No. You've got plenty of time to get the full liquidity when markets might be more favorable to you. But for right now, what we would try to do, especially to calm people who were panicking just a month or two ago, what we would try to get them to do is let's look at your existing dollars because you don't need 100% of your portfolio on day one. That is key. So let's say you do that, listener, and you start to realize, wow, some of my money is already, quote unquote, positioned. I wasn't looking at my portfolio individually. I was looking at it as one, and I was watching that one drop. But you're right. The parts, the components of my portfolio, some of them haven't dropped at all. Some of them have actually gone up. Some of them have maintained. And wow, I can see that I can fund the first couple of years of my fund spending and my minimum dignity floor with assets that I have. Now, I'm laying out a nice scenario there, and hopefully it did work that way. But if it didn't work fully that way and you still need to replenish a couple of years, if you're still 5 years from retirement, you don't have to get those cash dollars right away. One of the things you can do is look at your annual contributions you're making. I don't want to start making hypothetical assumptions, but maybe you're contributing already $20,000, $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 a year. And if you're married, maybe twice that amount. Maybe those dollars start going into the stable value fund if you have a 401k or an ultra short-term bond fund if you have a different type of account, or the G fund if you're a federal employee with the TSP. That your current contributions for the next 5 years could equal a lot of the money that you're going to need in year one. It's possible. Don't forget to look at contributions. Okay, so what if you looked at both of those contributions, existing holdings, and you're still a little off? You understand you don't need all 1.8 million on day one of retirement, well positioned. To me, you would want 2 to 5 years in day one of retirement in 100% principal protected holding. And as Jacob will explain shortly, that does not mean necessarily cash. You can still get an earnings on it. But start to keep in mind when you develop a position portfolio, if you believe in our approach is the natural byproduct of determining your fund number. To get to your fund number, I have to separate out all this other spending. Now that I have it separate, why would you want to put it all back into one big portfolio and it gets all lost in there and you can't see it? I like leaving it separate and investing it for what we call TSR, targeted spending inflationary rate. We used to call it your targeted rate of return. I stopped doing that because people we were working with were getting confused by it and thinking that that's what we're going to aim for as the return. That's all we're going to do. If you had a TSER, if the targeted spending inflationary rate of a particular holding was, say, 3.8%, which is a typical TSER that we might use, 3.8 to 4.2 on FUN, for we call that recreational CPI. It doesn't mean that's what I'm going to try for. It means I want to do better than that, but we want to try to at least get no less than that, but preferably more, with a degree of principal protection. We believe passionately in benchmarking, so I have to give someone I'm working with an idea of what we're trying to do with their money and a way for them to measure if we're delivering what it says we're going to be delivering. So that's why in positioning, we look at the TSER, the targeted spending inflationary rate. This is an important concept, whether you're in the Venn diagram or in a positioned portfolio, to start paying attention to you no longer need market rates of return on every single dollar. Get that out of your head. You're entering retirement. Everything you do now is the opposite of when you were in the accumulation phase. We're going to have to do that opposite show again, Chris. It's been too long. We keep referencing it. I got to do that show again. But it truly is the opposite in retirement. And in retirement, you should be concerned or looking at your targeted rates of return, the TSER, targeted spending inflationary rate. So as you start looking at your different holdings, you just want to make sure that the potential return of those holdings will at least keep pace with the inflationary pressures on that reserve spending. It's an important concept to remember. The final thing that I want Jacob to step back in here now is when we say a degree of principal protection, Jacob, it doesn't simply mean leaving dollars in cash, because this gentleman who sent the email was concerned with markets being down and would it be wise to get out now. And what I tried to get him to understand last week, and what I want you guys to understand going forward, there are ways, we call it a lateral. If you're taking some money out of equities, but putting it into a principal protected product that still is going to have equity-like returns up to a certain level, I'll concede that. If you put principal protection on the downside, you are going to curtail your upside. But if you are laterally moving from equities that have no downside protection, were causing you consternation, fear, and loathing, and sleepless nights because the president said he's going to tariff something and all of a sudden the market's going down, or a couple of years ago it was interest rates going up, or a year or two before that it was COVID, or a decade before that it was a housing market bubble. Whatever is causing the market to drop, I don't give a damn about it. I've said that before. It's always something different. The fact of the matter is, markets will drop. The thing that causes the issues with the person who sent the email and most of you listening, you think looking at your statement is what you have. It's not. If it's what you had, it would be in your bank account. It's not. It's what you would have had if you sold it on the day that statement was produced. If you're looking at a statement that came in the mail a week ago, it's pointless now. That was a week ago. It's a statement, and you guys know this, but you let yourselves forget this. It's not yours. And I don't think we as a society spend enough time telling people that. A statement is not what you have. It's a snapshot in time of what you had, past tense. It's not yours until you sell it and truly move it to cash. And cash to me means 100% principal protected. It does not mean literal cash. And that's where we start trying to use in our practice a lot of these buffered products. We don't use them as a growth part of our management. If we're working with someone who's 45 or 50 or 55 and they hired us for one of our growth models, we have five models, you all know that. If we're in that, we're not buffered at all in that. But if somebody is coming to us and needs 100% principal protection, why would I ignore? And they're in equities now, but they need to move a couple of $100,000 in principal protection. They don't have enough existing holdings to come up with the dollars they need. Even if the market is down, if you're moving equity to equity, what's it matter? Now, granted, if the market is down, if their portfolio is down 40%, 50%, and they're moving to a buffered product, no, I'm going to have an issue with that. But if they're down 5.2, which is what the S&P is down as of today, year to date, and they're going into a buffered product that's going to, from that point forward, remove any of the downside volatility from that point forward, but it might limit their growth to 6, 7, or 8% a year on the upside, why wouldn't I do that? It's going to give them the emotional protection they need, but with a growth potential greater than cash. I cannot stand when these buffered products are poo-pooed by asset managers who don't want you doing them. They want you investing in their portfolio, and they want to take 1% of your assets, and they're going to manage it for you, and they're going to tell you you're foolish to limit your upside. And you are foolish to limit your upside if you're 20, 30, 40, 50 years from retirement and you're using those damn buffered products. But if you are 5 years from retirement and you're panicking and you want to protect some dollars, but you only have to match your TSER, your targeted spending inflationary rate, why would you lock yourself into cash, which could pay you around 3.5 to 4.2 right now, when you might be able to get double that tied to the equity markets, which you're fairly comfortable with? It's not saying you have to do it, but it is something to consider. And you're lateraling, in my opinion, equity to equity. True, you are laddering an uncapped equity to a capped or limited upside equity, but that's the trade-off for full 100% principal protection. And you should be analyzing that particular move, not for how much growth you're giving up. People who talk that way, they don't understand distribution planning. They're too steeped in accumulation and growing wealth. They can't see the forest because of the trees. They're idiots. I don't know how to put it. They're fixated on growth and not paying attention to downside and what Chris shared. The unhappiness you feel on the downside. And what I share, I don't want people holding off on spending on fun because on any day they can be the other guy and they're never going to be able to spend on fun again. So I'm more concerned with giving them that emotional downside and trying to say, hey, for recreation, we look at recreational CPI. Now, we're not huge fans of the way the DOL does recreational CPI, but we're content with it, which right now, I think, Jacob, we're lower than 4.2 now, are we? What are we using on that?
Yeah, that 3.8 figure that you mentioned.
So if that's the teaser of fun is 3.8, And you can get a potential if the market delivers 6, 7, 8% upside with no downside. And you could reasonably lateral over, not with a 50% loss, but a 5% loss. I would have no problem with that. Especially as Jacob rightly pointed out, if those assets you're lateraling over are still overall up 30, 50, 80, 100, 200% from when you started investing 5, 10, 15, 20 years ago, what's it matter? There's no rule that says thou shall not reallocate except at an all-time high. There's no rule that says that. And what I'm trying to help you overcome is these irrational, emotional reactions to volatility, which is to either A, panic and sell, or B, hold off on spending until, quote unquote, things change because this time is different. I don't want to hear that. I just want you to chill and enjoy your retirement, especially during the go-go phase. So, Jacob, I long set up, but talk about how you would navigate some of that now and how people should look at these things.
Yeah, can do. I think the easiest way, listeners, for me to maybe kind of try and walk through how we approach kind of specifically maybe building these kind of liquidity ladders, these liquidity timelines that we're talking about for the delay period MDF and kind of that go-go fund spending is, I'm just going to talk about how we would look at this, assuming the person's, you know, in day one of retirement, right? So I know our listeners kind of 5 years from retirement. I'll bring it all back around here at the end of my tirade here, but let's just pretend, right? This person, we're looking at day one of kind of retirement and we're saying, hey, okay, he's entered retirement, right? We know what our delay period MDF set aside is going to be for the next 12 years. We know how much money we're kind of penciling in for go-go fund spending for the next kind of 15 years. And we're going to start to kind of break down and build these kind of liquidity timelines. The reason I'm saying liquidity timelines, and this will apply to both the delay period and the go-go fund spending, rather than specifically kind of a traditional kind of ladder in an investment sense, is when we do this for clients and when we kind of look at things, yes, we are going to get, guys, the annual kind of, you know, anticipated liquidity amounts year by year. And for, in this case, the next 12 years on MDF, the next kind of 15 years for fund spending. The way that we arrive upon getting those dollar amounts for MDF and fund spending does differ a little bit. I won't get too into detail on this episode, but just to kind of give a general refresh on how we kind of look at this. For the delay period, that minimum dignity floor, those are kind of more fixed expenses, right? The food, transportation, housing, healthcare, utilities. I know I did those out of order, but follow me. The required kind of expenses there. Those are expenses, right, that listeners, you yourselves, clients we work with, right, you've had those throughout your entire life, right? You've had an entire lifetime to get a good feel for reasonably what you know you're spending on those kind of minimum dignity floor style expenses, right? So in our office, right, when we're looking at this for a client, and especially if they've gone through a retirement plan with us, right, we feel pretty confident that we can sit down and look at the data from a plan and kind of say, hey, okay, you know, these folks, they have a good understanding of what their kind of MDF expenses are. We can kind of take the data from the plan year by year and really honestly rely on that as we're kind of building this liquidity kind of timeline that I'm talking about for the minimum dignity floor. So we can get a good idea if, like, again, I know we're using 700,000 as kind of our total set aside example for, you know, 12 years, right? But let's say in year one of the MDF, they're projected to need 110,000. Then year two, it's 85,000. MDF varies a little bit, right? Just because expenses are going to change kind of year by year. But we can take that data from the plan and kind of plug it in to go year by year, how much we anticipate somebody needing to withdraw from assets to cover some of those minimum dignity floor shortages for the next kind of 10 years. Minimum dignity floor, it's pretty straightforward as to how we would look at getting those kind of year by year amounts. Fund spending differs a little bit from that kind of approach, because although clients that we work with, right, they've given us some assumptions for year by year, how much they anticipate themselves to spend on discretionary fund items, Jim would agree, you know, over the last kind of 5, 6 years that we've been doing this for folks, regardless of what we found folks kind of list as the assumptions for fund spending in the plan, as they enter retirement, the actual dollar amount that people find themselves spending just varies drastically from what was listed in the plan. And that's not for everybody, right? Sometimes maybe somebody's on top of it and they nail it, right? They say they're going to spend XYZ in the plan, they enter retirement, and they actually end up spending XYZ on fund. But usually that's not the case. There's a lot of variability, a lot of flexibility on fund spending specifically. And so when we're sitting down with a client and we're kind of looking at the go-go kind of fund spending liquidity timeline in general, the question I always, and we always kind of ask folks is, in any given year, as you enter this period of your go-go fund phase in retirement, what is the maximum dollar amount that you could see yourself spending on just specifically go-go discretionary fund items throughout that kind of period? And I'll encourage folks, if they're single, right, I'll encourage them to go and think about it and come back to me with an answer. If they're married, I'd encourage them to have a discourse and discussion together, take as much time as they need to kind of come up with a reasonable estimate of what they feel that amount might be. And there's no right or wrong answers to this question, right? I'm not proposing that to folks to get an idea and to hold them to it, and provide a budget, right? That's really not our goal. All that we're saying when I ask that question is, from an investment standpoint, right, in that first, 1, 2, maybe even 3 years of the anticipated kind of fund spending need, I want to make sure from the investment side of things, these folks are going to have that maximum amount of liquidity maturing, accessible, ready for them to spend on fund in any given period. Whether or not they actually find themselves spending a little bit more than that amount, a little bit less than that amount, totally fine, right? I think it can't be understated enough that, and I know Jim touched on kind of the psychological aspect of this as well. With somebody who's entering retirement, it is going to be scary. And I think it's also important to acknowledge that as they enter retirement, you could think you're going to do all this fun spending, all this travel, visiting any grandkids or, buying presents for somebody, whatever it might end up being, But as you actually find yourself entering retirement and starting to spend on these discretionary items, you'll be amazed that in the first 1, 2, 3 years of retirement, I truly feel that you'll have a much better understanding of what you and your partner, if you have one, or you singly find yourselves actually spending on fun as you progress through the first couple of years of retirement. Those are going to be a big phase where you get a lot of intel on, hey, I thought I was going to spend $100,000 on just fun in the first year. I actually ended up spending $120,000. Totally fine, right? There's no right or wrong answers. It's just kind of an exploratory process where you're going to start to get a better feel for how much you're finding yourselves actually spending on fun. And so when we're starting to kind of put together this liquidity, timeline, kind of tying it back to that, right? Let's just pick on our, I don't mean to pick on our listener himself, but our hypothetical example, right, where their fund vision period was 15 years. Let's say I asked that listener the question, and they got back to me and they said, "Hey, Jacob, in any given year, we don't see ourselves spending more than $120,000 a year on just specifically discretionary fund." Right? That's perfect. That's what I'm going to do then is I'm going to encourage that listener to say, "Hey, let's make sure at least for the first maybe 1 to 2 years of retirement, you've got that 120,000 set aside in fully principally protected liquid dollars, ready to go, ready to be spent on fun." And if you listen to our last episode and maybe even the episode before that, right? Those are dollars that I would earmark in kind of that liquidity account concept, right? Hopefully, those are dollars that can be accessible. They're liquid and ready to distribute, but they're also flexible from a tax standpoint to have this listener to kind of get out and spend on fun. So really, the first couple of years, those first couple of years, I want to set aside that maximum amount because it provides a jumping off point, right? If you will, I'm picturing in my head for some reason, a diving board of somebody who's entering retirement and they need a starting point, a jumping off point on setting aside money without yet fully knowing what they're actually going to find themselves spending on fun. And that's kind of what that maximum amount gives you. It's just a starting point, acknowledging that just like we talked about on previous episodes, right? Anything in positioning, money is fungible, and this is all made out of jello. If the client finds that a year or two into spending on fun, they're spending significantly more, significantly less, dollars can be moved around, and we can change kind of that liquidity timeline to better reflect what somebody finds themselves spending. So conceptually, before I kind of get into how we break down the ladders and, you know, the types of investments that we kind of look at this, I think it's important to kind of look at how we, you know, calculate and kind of quantify those two different spending timelines, the MDF and the fund spending. They're similar, but they're a little bit different in how we kind of look at them. So perfect. Now we've got an idea of how much those ladders are kind of, you know, how we get those ladders, how we kind of set out the annual liquidity. The next concept I want to kind of talk about is, although we're talking about 12 years in the MDF and 15-year kind of periods for fund spending, this timeline approach, rather than being a traditional kind of investment ladder, right, where you're just saying, hey, I've got the next 12 or 15 years, kind of the anticipated liquidity laddered out, right? I want to make sure it's in, you know, CDs or bonds or, you know, whatever it might be, the MIGAs, multi-year guaranteed annuities, right? Rather than laddering out each of those 12 or 15-year periods to have the money mature specifically for that anticipated year's needs, in the liquidity kind of timeline approach and how we work with clients on this is we'll essentially kind of break it down into a couple of chunks, right? Like Jim mentioned earlier on this episode, the first kind of 1 to 5 year period, folks, that is where we're going to prioritize that full kind of principal protection, right? I won't get too detailed into, you know, specific investments, right? But you're going to look at things like CDs, you know, short-term treasury bills, maybe the MIGA, the multi-year guaranteed annuities, things like that. Maybe even that 100% buffered ETF that Jim was kind of talking about, right? Those first kind of 5 years are really where we're going to prioritize the full kind of principal protection. Let's say, and let's stick with this client example, right, where they've got a 15-year go-go period. Let's say years 6 through 10, so kind of the second third, if you will, of this time period, right? That's where that concept of a degree of principal protection kicks in, where much like we talked about on the last episode, we're sitting back there and we're saying, hey, you know, even though this money's earmarked towards fund or MDF, you know, it doesn't have to specifically be allocated all in something with full principal protection, locking in a single digit kind of interest rate, right? Years 6 through 10, there's a little bit of runway there. And granted, don't get carried away. It's not too far away, right? But there's a little bit longer kind of runway there where you can sit back and say, hey, maybe I am comfortable with a degree of principal protection and using something like, you know, the 10, 15, 20% buffered ETFs, where you're not necessarily locking in a single digit interest rate like you would in a MIGA or a CD, but you're giving yourself the potential to participate in a little bit more market upside tied to 100% equities while still giving you some downside protection from an emotional standpoint, right? That's what we mean with a degree of principal protection. So that's what you might look at for kind of that year 6 through 10, kind of second third of the timeline, right? The final third of the timeline in this example for this specific client that we're talking about here, right, because they've got a 15-year go-go period, is, you know, years 10 through kind of 15, right, or 11 through kind of 15. And even if they started retirement today, right, and we're truly looking at them anticipating needing this money 11, 12, 13, 14, 15 years from now, you know, Jim and Chris would agree as well, right? That's a long enough time horizon where if the client is comfortable with it from a risk tolerance standpoint, right, an emotional comfort level standpoint, those are dollars that can remain invested just based on the client's risk tolerance, right? You've got a long enough time horizon there where you don't necessarily need a degree of downside protection, unless, right, from an emotional standpoint, you're sitting there and you're thinking, hey, that's great, Jacob, but I would sleep better at night if I knew I had, you know, 10, 15, 20, 30, whatever it might end up being, you know, percent, you know, downside kind of protection. And that's totally fine. But I would just say in general, right, for that kind of last third of that last kind of tranche of the liquidity ladder in this example I'm talking about, that's a long enough time horizon where we would feel comfortable letting somebody keep those dollars allocated if they were comfortable with it from a risk tolerance standpoint. So keeping in mind right now, we've got a good idea, hopefully a good understanding of how this kind of liquidity timeline would be built, assuming somebody retired right now. Let's take it back to our listener that we've kind of been talking about in his specific example, where he's 5 years from retirement, right? That puts it into an entirely different perspective, right? If you're 5 years from retirement, you don't need to set up that full kind of ladder that I just kind of talked about, right? But it's important to kind of keep in our heads because, again, like we've been saying, you know, yes, the first 1 to 2 years, right? 5, 6 years from now for this listener, we are going to want to at least hopefully they can get those into, you know, principal protection, maybe that liquidity account that we've kind of been talking about. But that middle chunk of the liquidity kind of timeline that I was picking on, right, with the degree of principal protection that in our first example wasn't anticipated to be needed for years 6, 7, 9, and 10. With this listener, they're 5 years away from retirement even. So they're 7, 6, or even, they're 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15 years away from that middle portion of the liquidity timeline that I was kind of talking about, right? And again, when you get to that time frame and you've got that runway and you're 10, 11, 15, 20 years, whatever it might end up being away, again, I think this listener can take some solace in the fact that those dollars can remain invested as long as they're okay with it from an emotional standpoint. If they are sitting there and they're looking at the market and they're seeing the volatility and they're freaking out and they're truly losing sleep over this, then yeah, maybe they want to try and kind of start to protect a little bit more than what I just talked about. And maybe they look at doing some of the lateral moves into something like the 100% buffer, like Jim just talked about. But gosh, I would say if you're sitting there and you're 5 years away from retirement and we're looking at 10, 11, plus years down the line, again, I think a lot of that money for this gentleman could remain kind of invested if he's comfortable with it. And he really just needs to focus on those first kind of, 1 to 5 years of that liquidity time that I talked about, and at least starting to get the first couple of years of that portion in kind of principal protection. So hopefully that's helpful. I know it's a little bit confusing when, you kind of look at the two different time frames I described, but I think it's beneficial to kind of look at how we would visualize this and how we would start to kind of break this up with somebody retiring today. And then you look at this gentleman who reached out, who's got 5 years from that point in time, they've got even more flexibility, even more time to start kind of making some of these changes. And much like we've kind of been talking about, for the last couple of episodes, right? Conceptually, hopefully they're sitting there now thinking, hey, they're right. I don't need all this money at once. I'm not going to need all this money at once. And I don't have to make all these different kind of changes or positioning changes all at once, right? For this gentleman, there's a probably a decent portion of money that can remain invested, and is earmarked for, again, 10 plus years from now, where they're going to have a lot longer time horizon to start kind of progressively making some of these kind of changes and these positioning kind of updates. Obviously, the caveat, or not kind of the caveat, but the one thing I'll kind of add there, right, is when you look at that kind of ladder, as this gentleman or as any client that we work with or any listener out there, as you get closer, obviously, to when those dollars are anticipated to be needed, right? So let's say we were looking at, 10 years from now, but we're sitting together in 2030, it's been 5 years, and now there's only a 5 year window. Obviously, we're going to want to start to dial back some of that risk for this person. And then hopefully they've used the last kind of 5 years to start to kind of start doing some of these positioning changes and start kind of moving things around. But I don't think they need to overreact. I don't think they need to panic into trying to set up everything all at once right now, based on, short-term volatility that we're kind of seeing. So hopefully that's helpful. And hopefully, Jim, that's where you wanted me to kind of go with that.
I think you did an excellent job explaining all that, Jacob. One thing I'll say, if you do the podcast more, don't take over the whole show. Follow me. I'm very pithy, to the point, and don't ramble. But you're learning. You're doing good. Don't you think he's doing good, Chris?
That was great. Gave me a bit of a break. Right.
You
So,
did excellent, Jacob, and I hope listeners understand some of this, Chris. You're more of the planning side. What would you be suggesting to this person if they were on a Zoom call with you? You don't do much of the investing side, but what would you be sharing beyond what Jacob, if anything, shared?
Well, I think they're certainly within that on-ramp period, that 5 years and closer to retirement, that they should be seriously doing their best to put together some projections. Because the best way to, I'll reiterate what I mentioned before, that this whole concept of positioning is all about putting dollars where they should be to perform their job at the time the job needs to be performed. And to identify the job and the time really takes some forecasting, if you will, or projections, what most people would look at in a retirement plan. So to inform you as to what the dollars need to do when, there's nothing better, I think, than a retirement projection that looks into the future takes what, at least as many of the things you know pretty confidently. Jacob made a good point. Most people have a good handle on their minimum dignity floor expenses because you face those right now. You're just covering them with your salary before you retire. So those are usually, for most people, pretty easy to put together. Even if they don't do detailed budgeting, they can usually get pretty close with some reasonable estimates in there because they're just experienced with it. They know about what they spend on those food, utilities, transportation, housing, and healthcare categories. The fund does baffle a lot of people because their fund budget is likely to be quite different after retirement than before retirement. But I think you do a little brainstorming with your spouse, if you've got one, and come up with some things. I think you can get some pretty good estimates, especially for the first, say, 10 years of retirement, that can really help you figure out what you need to position appropriately for distribution rather than where it's probably been positioned all this time for accumulation. And so I think that's the first part of the story. From a planning standpoint, is get some of those projections in place and then look at, you know, everything that Jacob and Jim have shared with you to this point. Because without that, you're kind of shooting in the dark a bit.
Okay. Well, I think this hopefully helped this listener and everybody try to get an idea of ways to navigate not only market volatility, but the Venn diagram transitional phase of retirement and start getting your portfolio ready to retire. And for those who don't do this, for those who don't try to be proactive, like the gentleman who emailed us 5 years from retirement, for those who just, again, fall victim to recency bias, markets go up more than they go down. And it's easy to trick yourself. And I think Jacob and Chris will all agree. We plan as a team here at the firm. And when we're doing our group meetings and there's five advisors in this meeting, we sometimes see people who are a year from retirement, 90 plus percent in equities, if not more than 90. Correct? I mean, we have all seen this.
Yeah.
And during bull markets, that's very common. But I think what the tariff tantrum showed and the COVID crash showed, and to a lesser extent, they called it the taper tantrum when interest rates were rising, that these market corrections can come out of nowhere. And they're often very brutal on the downside, very quick, much quicker on the downside than on the upside, but for a much shorter period of time. Most bear markets last 18 months or less. And the COVID one was 6 weeks. This tariff tantrum, which I wouldn't even call a bear market because I don't think we lost a full 20%, is proving to be very, very minimal when you see. I mean, at any time, the guy can say something else and the markets will start crashing again. Don't get me wrong. But what I'm trying to say is if you let recency bias cause you to approach retirement ill-prepared for a market downturn, not only is retirement going to freak you out, a market correction is going to even freak you out more. And put both of those together, you may delay your retirement, or you may start to emotionally get these regrets and you're not going to spend. And that's what we want you to avoid. So being proactive in the Venn diagram phase, acknowledging I'm leaving my accumulation years, I'm entering my distribution years. We're changing. We look different physically. We feel different physically. But we also have to manage our money differently fiscally. And you have to acknowledge that and start prepping for it. look at what I'm doing, trying to prep for a potential move to the Midwest. And I've been talking about it for 3 years. You need to do the same. I don't mean you have to stop prepping for a move, but you need to stop being proactive with your investments as well. Don't let a down market trick you into thinking it's going to go down forever, but don't let a bull market trick you into thinking it's only going to go up forever. And don't think you are going to be able to identify when the next market correction is going to happen, that you are so smart, so brilliant, that it's going to be flagged weeks, if not months in advance, and you're never going to fall for it. Nobody knew that on April 2nd, Trump was going to go out there after the market closed and say what he said. Nobody knew less than 2 weeks later he was going to go out there also in the afternoon and say what he said that turned everything around. It can be caused by anything, it being a market correction. You need to be disciplined. And Chris has said this repeatedly. 5 years is kind of the sweet spot. You're about 5 years from retirement. You have to start looking at running a retirement analysis. And from an investment standpoint, you have to decide for yourself. Even if you do the safe withdrawal rate, most advisors who do the Monte Carlo probability statistic safe withdrawal rate still want you to have 2 years spending in cash-like holdings. So you can be spending from them if in the year you retire, things are down and you don't want to do your 4, 4.7, 5.2, 2.8, whatever the hell your safe withdrawal rate is that you decided. You want to avoid debiting from a portfolio when it's down. That's not a lateral. Lateraling, I'm fine with. Spending, removing those dollars forever from ever going back up. No, that you want to try to avoid in a negative down market. So even Monte Carlo probability-based statistic, you need to start building some cash reserve and you need to do a plan to figure out what you need. So if you're in the Venn diagram, do a plan. Don't panic. Do an inventory of your own investments to see which ones already have some degree of principal protection, if any. And recognize you don't need 100% of your money on day one of retirement. Try to figure out how much leeway you want, 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, 5 years. I don't think you have to go more than five. And I think anything less than two is a little too risky for me. Kind of defeats the purpose. 2 to 5 years of principally protected assets is what you should be striving for. And then, of course, when you finally pull the plug and you do retire, then you can start getting your full positioning plan in place, hopefully with a sound retirement analysis backing up the assumptions you're going to make. That's my summary. I'll let Jacob and Chris share their summary, and then they can wrap the show up.
Yeah, I'm not sure I have too much else to add. I think, you know, we covered a lot on this episode and the last couple of episodes as well. So hopefully it was beneficial to kind of look at, you know, how we would kind of approach this for somebody in that kind of transition phase. And then, you know, hopefully it's beneficial for folks who are already retired as well. I think it, you know, a lot of what we talked about kind of applies to both of those situations. So nothing too much more from me. What about you, Chris?
No, I don't think I'm going to add much other than, you know, this kind of wraps this little mini series, if you will. We ended up spending three shows on it, and we probably touched on everything that was triggered by that email from the listener. So we appreciate the prompt from the listener. I think it was valuable for us to go through. Hasn't been something we've gotten into this depth on for a while. So hopefully you all found it a bit enlightening, if you will, and encourage you to take whatever parts you might found viable or valuable and implement it into your own do-it-yourself strategies. And feel free, obviously, to bring it up with your, if you have your own advisor who's doing this, maybe you can incorporate some of this stuff with their help into the management of your assets, if that's what they're doing for you. So, yeah, that'll wrap the show for today. And we've got a Q&A show coming up here in a couple of days. We're going to have, I think it's a tax-focused Q&A show. So if you've got any last-minute tax-specific questions that you've got, now would be the time to send them in. Won't be much time, because by the time this podcast releases, we'll be recording that show the following afternoon. But if you do have any last-second tax questions you'd like to submit to Jim for consideration for that tax show we're doing in a couple of days, send the emails directly to Jim, jim@jimhelps.com. Put in the podcast, or not the podcast, in the subject line that it's a tax question for the podcast, emphasizing tax in the subject. And we'll have at least Paul on, maybe Paul, I don't know,
Paul
actually
and Jake.
Paul and Jake both. So Jake, an enrolled agent, works in our office, and Paul's part of our CPA tax team that works with us. And we'll tackle that in the next Q&A show. So everybody take care. Thanks, Jim and Jacob, for joining me, and we'll be back with everybody next week with a brand new show.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Salmier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Salmier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's Jim, HELPS.com. Or call 970-530-0556.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salmier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.